Symptomized by impious activities. Nana.
Various.
Narakaha.
Narakaha.
Hells.
Cha.
Also.
Anuvarnitaha.
Have been described. Manu
antaraha.
The change of manus. In one day of Brahma, there are 14 manus.
In one day of Brahma, there are 14 manus.
Cha. Also.
Vyakyataha.
Has been described.
Adyaha.
The original.
Swayambhuvaha.
Directly the son of Lord Brahma.
Yataha.
Wherein?
Wherein?
Translation, you've also described at the end of the fifth canto the varieties of hellish life that result from impious activities, and you have described in the fourth canto the first manvantara, which was presided over by Swayambhuva Manu, the son of Lord Brahma. So there's no purport to this text, so we read the next text with its purport.
Dara mandala samstanam bhagalakshanam anatkha yottisham vivaranam cha yachedam asujat vibahu.
My dear Lord, you have described the dynasties and characteristics of King Priyavrata and King Uttanapada. The Supreme Personality of God had created this material world with various universes, planetary systems, planets and stars, with varied lands, seas, oceans, mountains, rivers, gardens and trees, all with different characteristics. These are divided among this planet Earth, the luminaries in the sky, and the lower planetary systems. You have very clearly described these planets and the living entities who live on them. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hear the words, yathedam asrajad vibhu, clearly indicate that the Supreme, the Great, Almighty Personality of Godhead, created this entire material world with its different varieties of planets, stars, and so forth. Atheists try to conceal the hand of God which is present in every creation, but they cannot explain how all these creations could come into existence without a competent intelligence and almighty power behind them. Simply to imagine or speculate is a waste of time. In Bhagavad Gita, the 10th chapter, text 8, the Lord says, Aham sarva shatra, I am the origin of everything. Taksarvam pravartate. Whatever exists in the creation emanates from me. Iti matva bhajanti mam buddha bhava saman vitaha. When one fully understands that I create everything by my omnipotence, one becomes firmly situated in devotional service and fully surrenders at my lotus feet. Unfortunately, the unintelligent cannot immediately understand Krishna's supremacy. Nonetheless, they associate with devotees and read authorized books. They may gradually come to the proper understanding, although this may take many, many births. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the 7th chapter, text 19, Bhonam janmanam ante jnanapam man pravajyate vasudeva sarvam iti samahatma sudurlabha. After many births and deaths, he who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. Vasudeva, Krishna, is the creator of everything, and his energy is displayed in various ways. As explained in the Bhagavad Gita, 7th chapter, texts 4 to 5, a combination of the material energy, bhumir, apo, naro, vayu, and the spiritual energy, the living entity, exists in every creation. Therefore, the same principle, the combination of the Supreme Spirit and the material elements, is the cause of the cosmic manifestation. So, Om Ganatimirandasha, Gnanjana Shlakaya Chakshur and Meditam Yena Tasmai Shivarve Namaha. So what's being described in this verse is the cosmic creation and the subsequent manifestation or subsequent creation. Two of the main topics, as we were describing yesterday, of a Mahapurana. Remember we talked about that? Do you remember? Like the Mahapurana has to have certain characteristics, like creation, subsequent creation, maintenance, protection, and ultimately liberation. So here's this being described in the first verse of the purport, King Privrata, King Uttanapada. That's the subsequent creation, or the secondary creation. And this is very, very interesting, because after the Lord had Lord Brahma create the universe, or at least manifest the universe, actually it's not really a creation ex anilo, which means out of nothing, which is primarily what the scientists say, that out of nothing, many scientists, not all of them, out of nothing, you know, something appeared. But the material energy existed before the cosmic creation, which is interesting. It existed in the form of the pradana. Pradana means the unmanifest form of the three modes of material nature. An example I've given many times in that regard, it's like clay or silly putty. And you played with silly putty. Did you have silly putty when you were young? No. 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 You were unfortunate. And so silly putty you kept in like a little egg-shaped container. And you took it out, and then you played with it. You made it in different shapes. You were able to take impressions from your comic books and stretch them and things like that. Before you take it out of the egg-shaped container, it's not an egg, but egg-shaped container, it's like unmanifest. It's before the creation. It's your tiny little creation. And then when you take it out, then it manifests some shape, and then when you put it back in, it's unmanifest again. So that's boudoir, boudoir, paliate. Then the difference between the manifest and unmanifest stages, in the manifest stage, there's some intelligence supplied. And in the unmanifest stage, there's no intelligence being supplied to the pradana. You understand? So therefore, it reverts back to its original. Of course, it's called entropy in scientific understanding. That if you don't apply energy to something, then it goes to a simpler and simpler and simpler state. And eventually, you know, it's amorphous. It has no form. And we see this in the practical world, at least in our visible realm, that if you just leave something alone, then eventually, by the time factor, even this chair, for example, will go back into pieces of wood eventually and become something that's disincarnate, something unmanifest. It won't be a chair anymore. So, so the material creation is put into shape by Lord Vishnu, who glances at it, Saikshita, and this glance injects the Lord's energy, energy such as the living entities, like ourselves, and then things come into motion, and the planetary systems begin to take shape, and all that other nice stuff. But that's the primary creation. And the secondary creation is, you have to fill it up with living entities. You know, if you have a house, you build a house, you're building a house for living entities who live in it, isn't it? Usually, unless you're an investor, and you just buy a house or build a house to sell it to someone else. But eventually someone's going to live in it, hopefully. Otherwise it's useless. So there requires living entities to be put into this material creation, because the way the material creation is designed is that there are supposed to be living entities everywhere. There's no, like, space, empty space. Although there may be places without oxygen or air, that I understand. But there's living entities in a subtle form, even in empty or outer space. It's interesting. Scientists, they send these different explorers to the planet Mars. You've heard about this? Like, different robotic vehicles. And they go around, is this fit for water? There used to be water here 10 billion years ago. Living entities could have lived here. Listen, I mean, spend so much time useless. They drill down. Yes, there used to be water. So what? And even if you discover living entities, what are you going to do with them? It's like modern technology enables you to be in nonsense much more efficiently and effectively. Right? Previously, you know, let's say 100, 200 years ago, we were in Maya in a very unsophisticated way. Now we're in Maya in a sophisticated way. Or as one time, one devotee said that you know, people go up in airplanes and they act like animals so they can be considered flying pigs. Is that? I mean, not the pigs with wings, but before they were just pigs on the earth, and now they're flying in airplanes, so they're doing exactly the same thing. So what is the benefit? So, anyway, getting back to the point. So there's empty space in the creation, so there has to be every nook and corner has to be filled with living entities. That's the subsequent creation. And so, you know, how does that happen? You know, how do all these living entities... That's the business of the Prajapatis. Of course, Lord Brahma is the original Prajapati, and he has so many interesting living entities. But what's mentioned here, he has so many descendants, and some of them he creates from his mind, some of them he creates from his chest. He doesn't even need his wife to have children, which is pretty efficient. So what's being described here is the creation. Lord Brahma has a son, and his son, one of his sons, of course, is called... Manu, Swayambhuva, Manu. Swayambhuva is the original Manu. Like it's described here, there's 14 Manus in a day of Lord Brahma. So there's a Tamasa Manu, Chakshusha Manu, and I don't remember the names of all of them, and it's not really that important to remember all the names. But Swayambhuva means the original Manu, or the father of all mankind. Man and womankind too, so sorry. Because this is somewhat similar to the story of Adam and Eve. You know the story of Adam and Eve? Like, in the beginning, God created Adam, and Adam was kind of lonely. He didn't have anyone to get in trouble with. So they created Eve, and took one of his ribs out. The ladies had just come from a rib. So. Say, what can I do? I mean, that's the Bible. Don't blame me. So he took the rib out, and there was Eve, and Eve got him in trouble. Adam would have been fine, you know, if Eve hadn't come out. Sorry. So anyway, so you have the Manu, and then also Manu, Swayambhuva Manu was lonely, so there had to be a wife. Does anyone remember what his wife's name was? Starts with an S. Shatarupa. You understand? Satarupa. And then, obviously, he had a wife. Then he had to create some children. Human types of children. Manu was specifically responsible for human types of children. Other Prajapatis, such as Kashyapa, he had a whole bunch of different interesting family members. I mean, some of his children, like one wife, Kadru, they were snakes. Other times of a bird by Vinata. It'd be interesting to see the family reunion, wouldn't it? Because your cousins might eat each other. I mean, one may think, how is it possible for like a higher living entity in a human form to have snakes as a child? You know, how is it possible? Well, actually, if you look at it genetically, that we actually have similar, we have the same genes as snakes. Of course, we have more genes, and we're not just snakes. Although I know some people who are questioning. So, yeah, some people are like, she's a snake, or he's a snake. Snake in the grass. So, but you're actually seeing that there's the primitive genes we have, and then we have more genes than these snakes do. And it's so interesting. You can see that God is using the same sort of template for all living entities, but just like doing different things with that same template. That's very efficient. And that shows that there's a God. That, you know, people, of course, the scientists say, well, that shows that we all evolved from snakes. Or we evolved from one cell. I mean, the interesting thing is they say we evolved from one cell because there was reducing atmosphere and there was a lightning bolt and all of a sudden, you know, the proto-life occurred and after that you had real life. But, you know, they said it happened, but even when the scientists in their laboratories, they try to put that those conditions together and they can't even replicate them. I mean, they can't create life in the laboratory. Probably that was one of Prabhupada's main challenges to the scientists. That if you say life comes from matter, okay, do it. And there was one devotee who was preaching in Sri Lanka, in Sansaduda, and he said, you know, create an egg and have a chicken come out of it. You're such a good scientist. He challenged them. I mean, give you all the ingredients. You have your laboratory, which is pretty sophisticated, and just make a nice egg. You can't do it. So you actually see, you know, similar genetic structures in lower living entities and higher living entities. And you see the intelligence of God behind all these things. Like we were talking yesterday with Peter about different ratios that exist in the universe that are reflected both in the macrocosm and the microcosm. That means, I'll give you an example of what I mean. Like in the atomic level, there's different ratios between particles. And then you see those same ratios occur within planets in the solar system. And even those ratios occur in your spine between the, you know, in your spinal column. It's really interesting. And similar ratios. Now why would that be? If everything happened by chance, there'd be different ratios. And even in music. There are many books called The Music of the Spheres. You ever heard of that before? No. No one's ever heard of that. You've heard of that. The Music of the Spheres. And so you see intelligence behind everything. Wow, it's all just organized nicely. It's not just like a mess that someone just threw up in the air and we appeared. That's proof of God. I mean, that's positive proof of God. The order of the universe and the subatomic particles and the body and all these different elements interacting in such a wonderful way. You know, like all the different... If you look at your body, you see each part is interdependent interdependent with every other part, and the whole body is dependent on all the parts functioning nicely. So which came first? You know, which part came first of the body? Did a liver appear all of a sudden? Because a liver without a body is useless, and a body without a liver is useless, right? So it's interesting. You see, God's the footprint of God everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's God's footprints. His lotus feet. So, anyway, getting back to here the subsequent creation. So Manu, he had Shatarupa, and he thought, you know, we got to have some children here to fill the creation. He had, as I said before, he had human-like children. So then he came out with five children, two of which were described here as Priyavrata and King Uttanapada. Now, one of the reasons personalities like Manu would have children is that so that they can retire. Not so they could play golf or anything like that. You know, generally we think, you know, when am I, just like I was looking at my own age and saying, I'm going to be 65 and I can collect this and that when I'm 65. Someone said to me yesterday, oh, they may change it to 67. I was getting an anxiety about the whole thing. It's a nonsense government. So in the Vedic system, personalities like Manu, you know, high class people, Brahminical people, not Kshatriya, actually, just Kshatriya, they want to retire at a certain stage of life. And they want to just engage full time in devotional service. Because basically, you know, they're doing all sorts of material activities. I mean, it's not like working in a temple, just so you don't think that I'm advocating that devotees here should retire at a certain age. But working for Krishna in the temple is retirement. And you just, like Prabhupada said, give me the benediction of dying on the battlefield. He said, Prabhupada said, we want devotees like Arjuna, not sit-down devotees. And people just sit down. We want fighters who fight for Krishna, not with Krishna, or not with each other. So Prabhupada said, we want fighters. So, but retirement, when you have let's say you're a government minister, then you should retire from that, because that's not really like engaged in the process of sadhana bhakti or vaidhi bhakti. It's necessary, but it's really a lot of maya you got to deal with. I mean, a king has to deal with a lot of maya. Believe me. I mean, he's dealing with things that have absolutely no relationship with Krishna consciousness. So, Manu was thinking, it's an interesting story. Manu was thinking, you know, now that I had these kids, and I got them all married too. Actually, didn't get them all married. Prabhupada didn't get married at that point. But anyway, now that I've had these kids, now I should be able to just relax and chant Hare Krishna all day long. Or worship Radha Lokananda. He was thinking like that. But then he looked at one of his kids, Priyavrata, and Priyavrata had the audacity to accept instructions from Narada Muni. And Narada Muni had convinced Priyavrata not to take responsibility in the kingdom, and not to get married, and to be a sannyasi. And so, just like nowadays, you know, if you're in India and if you try to convince someone's son to become a sannyasi and renounce everything, I mean, it's a disaster. Sometimes, certain places, especially in Gujarat. Anyone here has been in Gujarat? In Gujarat, you don't see any Gujarati brahmacharis. All the brahmacharis in the temples in Gujarat are from Bengal. It's like that. Because, you know, the parents will not allow, they'd send their kids away, they're just thinking, how can we get our children married? That's their whole consciousness. So, Manu was something like that with his son Priyavrata. He was thinking, how can I get Priyavrata married? Not so I can enjoy the grandchildren, that's another thing. You know, sometimes people want to enjoy the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. They take a picture of themselves with their 5 generations, 500 people, you know, that all came from me. It's all false ego. But he wanted someone to take over so he could just engage full time in Krishna consciousness. So Priyavrata had accepted Narada Muni as a spiritual master, and Narada Muni really doesn't encourage people. He's not a matchmaker, generally. Narada Muni was saying, you know, just be full-time Krishna conscious, don't get entangled. And so Manu was getting upset. He said, what does sannyasi preaching to my son for? He should mind his own business. I mean, a lot of people get upset with Narada Muni. Daksha got upset with Narada Muni. Because Daksha had 2 groups of sons, 10,000, 1,000 sons, and he convinced them all to become sannyasis. And Daksha was thinking, this is just nonsense. So, Manu was also thinking, you know, what am I going to do? He wasn't thinking it's nonsense because he had respect for Narada. But he was thinking, now how can I convince my son when his guru is actually giving him the opposite instructions? So what he did is he overrode his guru. Because normally you can't say, Gurudev, you're wrong. Disobey your guru. You can't, because it's an offense. But there's a way you can actually get away without obeying the orders of your spiritual master. Is you find the param guru. You understand? The guru's guru. And then he can override your guru. It's nice, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, even in ISKCON they do that sometimes. So the guru says something, and then the disciple says, well, Prabhupada said, Gurudev, you gotta listen to Prabhupada. And the disciple goes, John, got it. So, anyway, so in this case, the disciple didn't want to disobey the guru. but the disciple's father wanted the disciple to disobey the guru. So Lord, so Manu, he went to Lord Brahma, who was the guru of Narada Muni. And he said, Lord Brahma, come on, we got some trouble here. My son, he wants to take sannyas, and you know, this is not appropriate. So then Lord Brahma arrives on his swan carrier in front of with Manu at the same time and with Prabhupada, and Narada Muni is saying, oh no. This is when I thought I got someone, you know. I lost him again. So yeah, it's like, it's similar to the story of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. When he was ready to give sannyas to someone, and the person's wife came and dragged him away. She said, what are you sitting here for, dear? You know, he was sitting at the fire sacrifice, getting ready to go swaha, and she said, you come with me. She pulled him by the ear. Uh-huh. In India, it's a tradition, you pull people by the ear. Ears are somehow really important, like if you're if you feel guilty, you hold both your earlobes like that. Right? You go down like that. Anyway, so there's something ritual to do with the ears that I haven't figured out yet. So you see this all the time. You know, people go like that. So anyway, so Lord Brahma came, and Priyavrata was forced to take the responsibility. And of course, he got married, and he had a nice kingdom. But later on, of course, Priyavrata got attached to the whole thing. That's showing actually there's danger even in the royal path, as Srila Prabhupada said. That even though it was authorized by his guru's guru, still he got attached, and then Narada Muni had to come and just like convince him, hey, remember the old days, good old days? And then Priyavrata said, yeah, you're right. At the appropriate time. So that was one son of Manu that's mentioned right here. And then, of course, Uttanapada, I think everybody knows about, because he's the father of Dhruva Maharaj, the great personality who, by his determination, was able to get a kingdom greater than the Lord Brahma, as a child, performing austerities. And then, of course, Swayambhuva Manu had other children. He had Akuti, Prasuti, and Devahuti. Yes, that's right. Devahuti was married to who? Do you remember? Don't you answer? Kardama Muni. Right. And she had like 9 daughters, and eventually she had as a son who? Lord Kapiladeva. And then, let's see, Akuti was married to the sage Ruchi. And she had, who was her son? Anyone know? Bhagavatam. Yes. She had the personality of God as her son. And his name was Yajna, or sacrifice. And so, there's also an interesting story with Manu, too, that Manu, he wanted to have God as his son, but he just didn't. So he made a deal with the sage Ruchi when he gave Akuti to Ruchi. It was like a tongue twister. Gave Akuti to Ruchi. And so when he gave Akuti to Ruchi, he said, I want to have your son as soon as he's born. And so he got the personality of Godhead as his adopted son. That was Manu. And then the other daughter was Prasuti. And Prasuti was married, one of the wives of Daksha. Anyway, so this is the story of the consequent or the secondary creation here. And so I think we touched upon most of these points. Yes. Okay, so any questions or comments about the creation, subsequent creation, topics of Bhagavatam, Swayambhuva Manu. There's other Manus too. I mean, there's different, 14 Manus in a day of Brahma. So, any questions? Everybody's tired? Questions, comments, arguments, problems, issues, discussions, requests? Yeah.
not on this subject, because this is so complex, I can hardly absorb it, but
yeah.
Other day, there was a concept of forgiving others who offend you.
Yeah.
That one's, under work, but there's some precept in the Vedas about acting like fire against those who offend
others.
Mm-hmm. So if you could, and I have a very hard time forgiving those who have
offended others,
affected others, and it wreaks havoc in my mind.
Well, as far as forgiving those who offend you, that's quite easy. You just have to be humble. That's very easy. I have no trouble being humble. I have not seen a more humble person myself. But anyways, because if you're humble, then you're not going to say he offended me, because you just accept. You know, if someone says you're a jerk, yeah, you're right. Someone says you're useless, yeah, you're right. But you don't do that with yourself. You don't say I'm useless, I'm a jerk. I mean, that's stupid. Humility is one thing; stupidity is another thing. But, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me, right? So, anyway, so as far as other people, if someone offends another devotee, you know, a Vaishnava, then it's appropriate to manifest anger. However, the anger should not be uncontrolled anger. It should be focused. So the problem is, the question you're asking is that how do you deal with the uncontrolled anger? You know, the anger just like wells up, and you become like a rakshasa, basically, wanting to attack. Then there needs to be some empathy. For the person who has committed the offense, then you have to have some empathy. And that means you have to see that this person is an illusion, needs to be corrected, and then you focus your language. It requires some intelligence. Like Krishna says that intelligence, although earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. So Prabhupada said intelligence is right there, right next to the soul, or the super soul. So the intelligence means that we control what we do with the intelligence. We control the mind. The mind is feeling this uncontrolled anger, but the intelligence controls it and says that this is not productive. What I need to do is teach the person a lesson, not make him suffer. There's a difference. There's a difference. Like it's of course in justice, in the principles of justice, that's called restorative justice versus retributive justice. Retributive justice means if someone does something wrong, you just want to make them suffer as a result. Restorative justice means we want to correct them. So we have to use our intelligence to focus on restorative justice, to correct the person who has committed an offense. Does that make sense? Commit an offense against another Vaishnava. And sometimes that correction has to be completely rejecting the person. Like Prabhupada had a discussion with one ex-disciple. The disciple was committing offense against Vaishnavas, and this disciple asked Prabhupada, what is my duty? And Prabhupada said, your duty is just to enjoy the material world. And the disciple said, well, you're my guru. And Prabhupada said, you have no guru. So, but Prabhupada said it in a very controlled fashion. It's not that he lost control. He understood this is the proper application to eventually correct the person. It may take many births. That was a very heavy interaction Prabhupada had in Los Angeles. I believe the person's name was Jamadagni, right? Where Prabhupada said, you have no guru. What is my duty? Your duty is to enjoy the material world. Whew. Imagine getting that instruction from a disciple. Oh, some disciples would want to get that instruction.